And we're live. Hi, everyone. It's your friendly ex-Muslim, Abdullah Samir. Welcome to episode 88 of the podcast. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. It's a special Ramadan episode. No, I'm just kidding. We don't care about Ramadan. It's not nothing to do with Ramadan. Just happens to be Ramadan. So today, I'm joined by a very wonderful lady, a Saudi ex-Muslim woman by the name of Ghada. Ghada has been around for quite a while, actually, pretty much longer than me, you can say, in the ex-Muslim movement. She's been a big part of ex-Muslims of North America since 2015. She was involved in a speaking tour called Normalizing Dissent, where they went all over the U.S. and they were talking about different issues in person, on campuses, and wherever. And and Ghada has an interesting story to share. So we're going to get into her journey and some of the things she went through. And we call it, the reason for the title will become apparent as we go through it. So how's it going, Ghada?
Hi, it's been very, very good. It's been a very hectic past year and a half or so, but I think we're getting the handles on things. I mean, there's ways to go out now, so I'm very happy.
Awesome. And I can see you're a coffee drinker too. I love my coffee.
Oh yes, this is my third cup.
Oh no, already?
One of the things I like to do, and my boyfriend says, is get over caffeinated and fight with people on the internet. I sometimes occasionally do that. I don't do that as much anymore.
good stuff. So why don't we start, you know, at the very beginning. You want to tell us about your background a bit?
Yes. So, and I don't know, I think you know this a little bit about me, but I grew up in a very Shia household. So I am originally from the eastern province in Saudi Arabia, a place called Al-Hasa, or Al-Ahsa, a city called Hafuf. My parents are cousins, they're related to each other, they're second cousins. They were arranged to be married at an older age, because in my family, most girls get married around high schoolish, or right after high school, and the boys is around the same time. We are big believers in young marriage. You know, mm-hmm. get them married young, get them having kids, as soon as possible, increase the umma, become all kind of strong. And of course, this arranged marriage, nobody really cares much about your options. You do have the option of saying no, but I mean, in the end, if it's somebody from, your family, and your father or your mother comes to you and he said, well, your uncle Muhammad wants you to marry his son Ali, you're gonna not say no, because you're your uncle, you love him, you respect him, you don't want him to be unhappy or something like that, and it'll cause rifts between families if you don't say yes. So most of the time you say yes.
So is it often cousins?
It's most of the time it's cousins, first, second. The way, and this was really disgusting, but the way I understood, at least this is my family, I'm not talking about everybody from Al-Hasa, I am not talking about all Muslims. My family is a specific, oh, hi boy, you're also from Al-Hasa. Well, hello. what I wanted to say is, in my family, we're a little bit more traditional. The way we get married is, once a girl reaches marriageable age, this is usually around 14 to 15, and somebody goes to ask her for her hand in marriage. If it's not a first cousin, they have to let the first cousins know, like, hey, our daughter is has a suitor. And if anybody wants her, this is your last chance.
Are you serious?
Second cousins, and then they go on until everybody in the family has already oh no, we don't want her, and then she can get out of the family. And that is if she's in the marriageable age. If she's above 25, 25. Oh my God, such old age, old maid. Nobody wants her. Then she, they don't have to go through all that bullshit, because
wow.
At that point, she's old enough. She's maybe too old for somebody in the family to want her. And most of the time, the guys, getting married are between 21 and 25. So
Jesus, this is wild to me. So yeah, if someone wants to marry you, First cousins get the first dibs.
So I had a story before I get in, like, about my story and everything. So when I got engaged back in 2009, 2010, still in college, he was another Shia, but from Al-Qatif, and not from Hassa. And people in my family were so angry that my mom and my dad didn't consult them before they accepted. Because, you know, I was still 20, 21 at the time, and how dare I, or how dare my family not ask the rest of the family if anybody wanted me. Somebody came to my mom, and then they were like, you know, whatever happens, marrying somebody in the family is always better, because you at least know them. One of my uncles asked me, one of my uncles explained this, saying that, hey, you know, at least we know the men in the family. We know that the men in the family don't beat their wives. They treat them well. They don't take second wives, which, by the way, that don't take second wives and don't cheat is bullshit.
Wow.
Because it does happen. Just because you only got caught once or twice does not mean that you didn't do it, or that it's not. Anyway, but that's how it is in my family.
Jeez. Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, I know one guy that had health issues. He's from the Middle East as well. And he said him and his wife were genetically incompatible. They tried, like, I don't know, 10 times to have kids. They went for a special because of this repeated cousin marriage and family marriage over and over and over again. He just can't have kids. It's just impossible, or like nearly impossible. Is that a common issue in your family, or is that not yet happened yet?
I hope it doesn't happen. But though, so my parents are first cousins, but their parents aren't. So my dad's parents and my mom's parents aren't cousins at all. They're not related. They are still from the same families that they marry from, and the same family from the region, but they're not related. However, because of the intermarriages that have happened since then, everybody's married to everybody, you know, because right now, like, the whole the whole circle of people, like the family that we marry from, they're all related to us, because at some point somebody married from them and had children, and then, you know, if not by blood, by marriage, like, everybody is related to everybody. It's also, even though it's not a small town, it has that feel, and it is the same with Shia in general, like in the Eastern Province. The Shia and Hassa and Qatif know each other, even though it's not necessarily a small area, but because we're minorities, because we are treated essentially the same way by the government, because of our last names, we can recognize each other. Mm-hmm. And it just became very well known. And also, if you look historically at the many different movements that the Shia have done, there has been collaborations between the Hassa and Qatif, or you know, just Hassa alone, or Qatif alone. But they talk to each other, and they know who each other are. It's kind of like it's a tight-knit community when you're a minority in a country that is as, you know, dictatorial, authoritarian as Saudi.
Yeah, Saudi is quite hostile to Shias, and that's big. Sure. Maybe a big part of it. Like, what, just quickly, I mean, not to get too much into it, but like, what sort of issues did you have being Shia in Saudi?
Right now, it's not as bad as it was, but I can tell you a little bit about how it was for me growing up. For example, my mother is a doctor. She graduated from a university in Saudi Arabia and wanted to do her residency in a program in Saudi. And she was rejected mainly because that program doesn't take Shia, just like that. You know, the program director just doesn't like Shia, would never accept them. So my mother her residency was delayed a very long time because of that. She ended up getting a much better residency. Like,
wow.
Fuck them.
Straight up bigotry. Like, we don't accept Shias. I mean, that would be like...
It's not much loud spoken. It's more of a... it's one of those things that everybody knows, because everybody knows that, oh, yeah, the program director does not like Shia, so he's probably never going to accept. It's almost like universally won't.
So it's not like you're not being accepted based on your merits. Like there's one guy that decides every single, like he's running it like his own personal family's business or something.
Oh, like well, he gets to even it doesn't have to be like even for government purposes. Nepotism is the biggest employer. That's how people get employed. That's how people get raises. That's how people get opportunities in general in Saudi and in the Gulf in general. But in addition to just that, like for example, Shia can't. Oh, hey, kitty. what a cutie. Shia can't be in the army after a certain point. They can't serve in certain positions in the army. They can't serve in certain positions that are considered sensitive. In school, I heard a lot of. I had at the beginning I pretended I wasn't Shia until of course they found out my last name. You know, when you're kids, nobody gives a shit. We just ask and you believe whatever the person tells you. So I just kept saying I don't know. And later on, of course, they found out and they kept asking me weird questions and been told that Shia say that they want to kill the Sunnis. Shia actually worship Ali. In school, we had a religion teacher that kept on mentioning like Shia things and how Shia, you know, they worship the dead. And then she would like look at me.
Oh my God.
Oh yes, man. Things mainly like that. Of course, there was, I'm not really sure if this document is still around. I should have looked this up, but there was a document written in the 90s. That was signed by a good number of Muslim scholars in Saudi that determined that Shia Muslims are not considered Muslims.
Oh, wow. Jeez. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that's worth pointing out, that even in Muslim countries, there's so much bigotry towards other Muslims. Whereas in Canada, like as a Muslim, I was treated better than the Muslims, Shia Muslims in Saudi, by non-Muslims. Like the rights that you have in the West, I mean, it's not that there's no racism. Of course there's racism, sure, racism is everywhere, but it's like it's blatantly open racism in some of these Muslim countries, whereas over here it's like, yeah, it's there, but you know, it's not as like, it's a little bit more subtle, it's, you know, more covert. And you know, it's worth pointing out that even Muslims are suffering in Saudi, it's Shia Muslims. And that's something I find quite interesting. Obviously, we all know Ahmadis suffer a lot as well in Pakistan. It's just, Muslim world is a mess. It's just awful.
It's a very unfortunate thing, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, so go on with your story.
So that's just an overview. What I really wanted to talk today about is mainly how I grew up and how, that caused, some trauma and how later on I was able to overcome that trauma. I mean, I'm still struggling, obviously, with it. It's not a linear kind of journey. You fall, you pick yourself back up, you get up. There's a lot of circles. Everybody's journey is different than somebody else. So I just wanted to give everybody an overview of who my parents are. My mother, though brilliant, she was very, very religious, very fundamental. She was really good at what she does as an ophthalmologist. She was actually the first strong female figure I've ever had. I always looked up to her, thought that she was strong, determined, sharp, witty, which she is. But she was extremely obsessive about Islam. Islam was the only thing that she could think of, and she only saw the world from the very narrow lens of Shia Islam and nothing else. For my father was still is, he's still alive. He's very quiet, reserved, but he's very quick to anger. We have a saying in Arabic, taqi al-hadim al-ghadab. If somebody is, you know, patient or not angry, then be careful of them. Angry because they become just boom, you know. And that's how my father was. He's still a liberal thinker, taught me everything about science and politics, gave me my first books on the Big Bang. He gave me Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, taught me a lot about the universe, the galaxies, gave me all sorts of literature on it because he studied a little bit of astronomy when he was in college. We discussed politics. He was a huge history buff. We talked a lot about history. But he was also a very overprotective Saudi man, you know, over his females and stuff like that, as any Saudi Arab would be. I hate saying this about my dad, but he is a coward that was subdued by society. I don't blame him, but he did let society kind of dictate his life. And he let also my mom dictate everything that was done to us. So it wasn't always bad, obviously. I mean, my parents did what they can do. They clothed us and fed us and, you know, took care of us and made sure that we didn't really need anything. But just to give you an idea of how religious my upbringing was. So when I was a kid, as a child, when my mom would tuck me into bed, I'm the oldest, by the way, I'm the oldest of four. I have three younger siblings. They're all boys. When my mom would tuck me in, she would tell me stories, bedtime stories. All of my bedtime stories were stories of the ancient prophets. If not the ancient prophets, it's stories of Muhammad. If it's not that, it's stories of the imams and Ahlul Bayt.
No nursery rhymes. It's kind of probably a dumb question, but I'm sure Saudi has like secular nursery rhymes too. Like, it's not only religious stuff.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know. Okay. There are any.
Yeah.
Most of the nursery rhymes I know are in English. Like, I knew Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and all of that stuff, but that's like it. I don't know if there's anything in Arabic. If there is, I was not exposed to it.
Okay.
I was only exposed to Islam. In addition to the bedtime stories, my mom would then ask me the same questions that I would be asked in the grave. Man Rabbuk, Madinuk, Man Nabiyuk.
Oh my God.
So,
can you translate those questions for us?
Once I was able to speak, my mom would recite those with me. She would be like, Man Rabbuk, Rabbi Allah.
Yeah.
Madinuk, Dini Islam. Man Nabiyuk, Nabi Muhammad. And then in addition to that,
Before you go further, so people who don't know, these are the questions that the angel will ask you in the grave. Who's your prophet? What is the other one? Who is the angel?
What's your religion? Who's your prophet?
And what's your book?
But then there's another thing that Shia add, which is Ma'iman Imam, who is your
Imam. Oh, wow.
Yes. So I would have to recite all of the Imams from Ali ibn Abi Talib all the way down to Mahdi, and they have to be in the order. So we did that every single day.
So it's much harder if you die as a Shia than a Sunni. Sunni only has to answer three questions. You have to answer four questions, and the last one is like the final boss question. It's like Ali, Imam Hussein. And you know, as an Ismaili, we used to recite all the names of the Imams too, but all 50 of them in the holy dua. But that wasn't a quiz question when you die. That was just part of the prayer, right? Yeah. So it's Ali, Hussein, Jafar Sadiq, and you know, it goes on. I don't even remember. It's a long list, right, of 49 imams until Shah Karim Al Husseini Hazir Imam, the current living imam in Ismailism, right? But that's interesting. And it's funny how it's like the questions are so easy. It's like, even as a non-Muslim, I know the answers, but apparently I won't be able to answer, right? Like,
you never know. You might die in your sleep. I mean, as a child, this is what was being told to me. So imagine being like 6 years old and your mom is telling you, I'm giving you these questions because you never know. You might die and you have to be answering these questions. So now that you know that you recited them just before going to bed, you'll be able to say them.
This is a good one. You said it's like those questions. Did you read the pinned post? Yes, I read the pinned post. You gotta... Oh man, that's a good one.
Yeah. And then of course we recite the Surah Al-Fatiha, Al-Ikhlas, the Mu'awwidhat, Ayat Al-Kursi, all of that just before going to bed. Every single night, never skipped. And I continued to do that even after like I grew up and my mom stopped tucking me into bed. I still did the Mu'awwidhat. I still did the reciting the imams because I didn't want to forget them. And because it was like so ingrained in me that I couldn't just forget about it. And then obviously, you know, when I got older, you know, 7 years old, learn how to pray, and then it becomes more of a like an obligation after 10 that they can beat you for it. And I have a story here because it's like my very first rebellious period. I lost a cousin of mine when I was about 6 or 7 years old. She was also my best friend. And at that time, I didn't have a lot of friends. I was bullied a lot. And she was very sweet to me and very young. She was my age too, so it's not like she was older or anything like that. So she passed away. I was very upset. I was very angry at Allah because how dare he take away, you know, the one friend that I had, the one person that I really liked and was, you know, nice to me. And I remember locking myself in the bathroom and crying and screaming, and so I stopped praying altogether. And at a young age, when you stop praying, you stop doing something, you forget about it. So then later on, about 2 or 3 years later, when my mom found out that I wasn't really praying, that's when I got into a lot of trouble. I lost a lot of trust from my parents. They never let me, pray alone. Like I had to pray in front of somebody and I had to recite everything loudly. So they made sure that I was doing it right. And they continued to do that for nearly a year to make sure that I was, you know, still praying and doing it correctly. And of course at 9, like all young Shia Muslims, I had hijab put on me. I didn't like it. I fucking hated it. And it made me upset that, you know, all of my friends, all my cousins, I mean, were, you know, running around doing their own thing. And if I wanted to run around, I had to be covered up.
And your whole family not wearing hijab?
No, they all wore hijab, but I was not. When I reached 9 years old, I had to wear it. And
most of
my cousins at the time were boys.
Oh.
Or if they were younger, the girls were still, you know, younger than 9 and they didn't have to cover up.
So and, before you add any more to this, sorry to interrupt. It's interesting that even as a young girl growing up in Saudi, you still didn't like hijab. I think that's something worth pointing out because, you know, we kind of just assume, especially, you know, people that were never Muslim, that, yeah, that's just the way it is in Iran. That's just the way it is in Saudi. Yeah, they're used to it. That's just the cultural clothing. That's just... But it's not the case. Some people don't like it, and you didn't like it. Some women don't want to wear hijab, and even at the young age, you know, you actually didn't like it. That's something worth pointing out, I think.
And it should be also worth pointing out that as I grew older, as I started like hanging out more around the older lady circles, they didn't like wearing it either. They just know that this is just what it is. It's, you know, the deen. The dean says I have to. I can't not do it. I mean, they wish that they didn't have to. A lot of them wish that they were boys, and so did I. I wish that I was a boy.
Wow, geez, that's a red flag right there in the religion, that you're growing up in a culture of religion where you wish you were the opposite gen. That just shows you how messed up the culture is. I mean, that's not normal. Like, you shouldn't, in no society should you have a woman wishing she was a man or a man wishing he was a woman because of the nasty, you know, like because of the restrictions or because of the way that, you know, certain genders treated. I mean, usually it's always women that get the, you know, the short end of the stick. It's never men, and it's never men. But yeah, that's a huge red flag right there.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate. I mean, you see it a lot. You see it, and it's not just, younger girls. Like a lot of like when we used to go to the beach and, you know, all the boys are wearing their swim trunks and they can do whatever they want and wearing our abayas. And like, even if we wanted to go into the water, we would have to be like away from everybody because we don't want them to see our ankles or like, or above, you know, that's haram. You might entice the 14-year-old cousin across. I don't know how these people think. So it's just things like that. It's, God, it was really, it didn't make any sense. It's like, it's everything. There's no choice. That's the thing about it. It's like when it comes to Islam, when it comes to religion, it's, you don't really have a choice because the other one is like, it's either you do it or you're sinning. And when you're a child growing up in a very orthodox household, sin is not an option. If you can stop the sin, you have to do it. You have to pray. You have to cover up. You have to, you know, act like the good daughter that we, or that we want. So it's one of the things, like, I hear from other people that they were kind of bad Muslims, you know, when they were growing up. And I'm like, how? How is it that your parents let you? Because my parents fucking watched me like a hawk. I couldn't not, I couldn't miss a prayer because my mom would be on my ass. And even if I lied, she would ask me all of these little questions to see if I really did or not, and immediately find out that if I not. And she, and here's the thing about my mother, and I don't talk, I didn't talk about this before because I was trying my best to not paint my family in a bad light. But unfortunately, and for this specific interview, I want to talk about trauma, but my mother is not exactly the best mother. She was a narcissistic parent. She wanted her children to be exactly the same way that she had sculpted in her mind. So she said, okay, I have a daughter. I'm going to make this daughter into the perfect thing that I was never able to become. I'm going to put it on this woman. So my mother wanted me to be girly, which, to be honest, I think I am, but not in her, in her mind. Like, I had to be a specific feminine kind of girl. She wanted me to be more of the, you know, go shopping, talk about all sorts of like hair, makeup, girl things, not have the, you know, the thoughts that I did, not be interested in reading about like astronomy or science fiction or fantasy or politics. She thought that that was too masculine. One time, yeah. She said that I was too masculine.
Jeez. Yeah, it's
dress, so I don't really know how that works, but
it's definitely I have 5 kids, and it's definitely a recipe for disaster if you try. I know very innately that every single kid is so different. Like, my kids are, they're so different in every single way. And my daughter is so different from my sons. And like, we thought she's going to be more like a tomboy because 4 boys, 1 girl. She's very like girly girl. Like, she likes playing with dolls and stuff like that. And although she is into gaming and stuff, but the point is, like, I have no control over that. I have zero control about how she, I mean, I can try to, you know, tell her things, but you can't force your kids to be what they're not, because that's just not who they are. You know, I strongly believe, and, you know, I was listening to an episode of Sam Harris's podcast where they, when you have identical twins that end up separated and growing up in different families, they're more alike each other than the parents raising them, meaning that genetics has such a strong influence on who we are, to the point of even it affects whether we're going to be fat or skinny, like tendencies. I mean, not, you can always go against that and like work out 5 times a day or whatever. And, but like, we are truly our genes plus our experiences. And you can't, you know, you can't force your kids. Like one of my sons, he's just not into academics. No matter how much I push him, it doesn't make sense for me to push him into that because he's better at other things. He's just not into academics. And so I would just cause a lot of pain in that relationship with my child if I kept forcing him to do something that he doesn't like. Computers, he's not into computers, but I'm like a complete nerd. So that just wouldn't work, right? And so I totally feel you, because I understand that your mom was trying to make you into something that you were not. And that's just wrong, you know, that's just sad.
And that leads I was going to talk about next, which is, like, for example, you look at it from a healthy perspective, because you, in your own self, you know who you are, you have your own identity, your wife has her own identity, and you're not trying to live your life vicariously through your children. You don't look at your children as an extension of yourself, as in, like, this child is me and I want that child to do things the way I want him to do it, because if he isn't, then that's a reflection on me, which, you know, that child, you as a parent have figured out something that a lot of parents haven't figured out, which is my children are individuals. They have their own personalities. They have their own thoughts and feelings. They have their own, they're not, no matter, you will find that with a lot of, if you do try, and I really hope you never do, but if you do try, for example, to like one of your kids, I'm like, I'm going to pick that kid and I'm going to try to force him to do something, you'll find immediately that it'll sour your relationship with that child. And that's something that my mom has done. And not just my mother, my father too, because they wanted us to be, the other thing that they care about other than religion, of course, is reputation. Reputation is the biggest thing when it comes to Saudi, even more important than Allah and Muhammad and everything. If people, when my father found out about me being, you know, not religious, he said, the problem isn't that you're sinning. It's that you are telling everybody else about the sin, that you are,
exposing your sin?
Yes, kind of like that. You're putting it up, you know, in front of everybody and showing it off. And that to them is even worse than being a Kafir, is being a Kafir and being, like, outspoken about it. So so reputation is very, very important. So if you don't follow how it is that you're supposed to be, which is, for girls, they have to be like poised, they have to be a certain way. Like, for example, my curls, they hated them. So
wow.
I either straighten my hair all the time, or the other thing that we did was my hair was very, very long. So my mother would either put it in a bun or braid it. So that was like the two ways I could wear my hair, or straighten it up, and that was the only way that I could wear it.
Can I ask, is this like your family is very, very controlling, but would you agree that the culture is more conformist as well?
Yes, the culture is extremely conformist, and they, like, for example, my father is a very liberal kind of man, but because he's all dedicated to his family and the religion, he conforms to the society. My family is the same way. I'm pretty sure even my mother doesn't have exactly the same thoughts as everybody in the family as a strong, independent woman, but she still has to conform because that's, what they need to do. And I want to also mention that there are other types of abuse that your family can do in order to make you feel like you're not enough. So it's not just going to be the conditional effect of you either be a Muslim or we don't love you anymore, but there's also the other abuses that happen. I mean, I didn't get physically abused because I'm a girl, and they wanted me to be preserved as a pretty specimen, so when they marry me off, there aren't any
bruises
in the birth.
Yeah.
So this merchandise has a lot of deformities, no more. nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
But if I did anything wrong, I was always immediately called different names. Deranged, stupid, idiot, fat, ugly, blind, retarded, disrespectful. If I did anything wrong to them, even if I didn't really do it, I didn't have a choice. Like if they came over and they found something broken, even though I was broken, but because, I'm the oldest, happened to be at the house, how did I not find out? And that's when they start yelling at me. And whenever I would try to defend myself, they would yell even more and accuse me of being disrespectful because I'm talking back. Because talking back is considered to be worse than even, being disrespectful to them, because it's, how dare you talk back to your family? And I'm pretty sure you know this Fat al-Walidain, which is
respecting your parents, right?
Yeah.
Honoring your parents.
Yeah, honoring your parents is always, when it comes in the Quran, it comes, worship Allah, believe in the Prophet, and honor your parents. Always together, always, and that's what my mom would always remind me. And she would use, so whenever I would be upset at something that they did to me, and a lot of it, and I'll just mention a few, being locked in a room when I was young, close the door, lock it in darkness if I did anything bad, being called different kind of names, what else, taking things away from me, like toys or video games or things like that, which is, I guess, normal, but being called names since you're a kid. And I've always been a very bright kid, really hard, always got like first or second in class up until I graduated from high school. My math was my favorite topic, still is to this day. I'm a fucking engineer. I love math. I do it every day.
Well, I'm not surprised you ended up ex-Muslim.
I mean,
it's true though. I mean, frankly speaking, there's a selection process that happens on individuals, and people that are constantly thinking, learning, growing, and are skeptical, or at least are trying to put two and two together, they tend to figure it out, right? I mean, that's just a fact. And people that are not willing to question, not brave enough to challenge the dogma, or conformist, even if they're intelligent, even like your mother, they're just not going to find their way out because they're not going to go through that process. They're just like, no, this is just it. I'm done. I'm not questioning, you know?
Yes. And the other thing about my family is that all of them together, their religion is very similar to a cult. Every single family member has to be the exact same religiosity. If you are just a little bit less, you're not. You need to be more. Like there's kind of like a line, a baseline of how religious you are, which is extremely religious. And you cannot go below that line. You can go above, of course. You know, go to Hawza, become a sheikh, become Ayatollah, whatever. But you can't go below that. If you're below that, then you better keep it to yourself and pretend that you are just like everyone else. And if you aren't, you're immediately attacked by every single person in the family. And it could be something as small as wanting a divorce from your husband because he cheated on you. And while the husband is part of the family, and he was seduced by that poor maid. I mean, she was a witch. She probably put something in his food, or even worse. And that's how he cheated on his wife. No, that's him cheating on his wife. And his wife fucking caught him and doesn't want anything to do with him. So she wanted to divorce him. So the family was against her because she wanted a divorce instead of the man that literally cheated on her.
I always have a hard time with understanding this. I just don't get how people go against their own kids. It's just, it's so bizarre. I don't know how this ended up. Like, I mean, it's so weird.
So, you know, I grew up in that. I grew up with never being able to have an option to do anything. So when I finally got to high school, and I, you know, in high school, I thought to myself, all I need to do is get good education that will get me the fuck out of here. So it was either that or get married, and I was looking at both. I mean, I did get engaged thinking that that was going to help, but that didn't end up working out, but that's okay. So when high school came along and I was thinking about going to college, I thought that maybe my father, being, you know, more open-minded, that he'll help out with like pushing my mom to let me go study in America, because I really wanted to be an engineer. And there's no way of me studying, especially this type of engineering, which is chemical engineering, in Saudi Arabia, because it's not available for women. There are no universities that teach. Even now, I think they have computer engineering. They have certain types of like software engineering, but there's no, traditional engineering like civil, mechanical, chemical. petroleum, whatever. Petroleum, I guess, is considered traditional for women. You have to go abroad to study.
Wow.
So, lucky me, the year I graduated high school was also the same year the Aramco CEO's daughter.
Sorry, what happened? You cut off for a second.
Oh, sorry. The CEO of Aramco, he had a daughter that also graduated the same year.
Wow. I graduated high school. Okay. So why is that significant?
She was actually in my class. And Aramco had a...
She was in your class?
Yes, she was in my class. I graduated. She's such a sweet chick. She's a very sweet lady. Very smart.
Oh, wow.
And she... yeah, I always respected her. I still do, actually. She's a very respectful little person. So she, I mean, I'm pretty sure, I mean, she wasn't the reason, she wasn't the one that went to her dad and said, let's do this. But so the Aramco had a college preparatory program where they also sponsored a bunch of boys to go study abroad, mainly engineering and other disciplines, and then come back and work. They did not have that for girls, but they opened it my year. So knowing my dad's love for Aramco and knowing that he believes in Aramco a lot more than any other country, any other like organization in the world, I thought this is what might be my only chance. So, but before I could even get in, I already had like, applied, did the exams and everything. And my mom told me, like, why are you so excited? You're not going anywhere. You're not going abroad. There's no way I'm going to let my daughter go and study in America on her own. Your options are here or Bahrain. And Bahrain was like 20 minutes away or 30 minutes away. And that really, really upset me. I got really angry. We fought a lot. And I won't say that this is the first time my relationship with my mom has been sour. When I was young, I was being bullied, I would go to her and she would just laugh at me. She was actually a bully herself by calling me fat several times and saying that my hair was ugly, that I don't have beautiful hair like she does, that I'm just ungrateful. I mean, I don't understand. Like, she just never really, and she never acknowledged that I was doing really well in school, except a few times that she acknowledged it. And it's like, no matter what I did, it seems like it's not enough, you know? Like, I can't be thin enough, I can't be smart enough, I can't be pretty enough, everything, I just can't do anything enough. And so that was the first time I realized that my mother maybe was not the nice person that I needed to always, because I only ever tried to get her to love me and to get her to accept me. That changed when she said that to me. She said that, and I remember I would tell her, the only reason you're doing this is because I'm a girl. She said, yes. So girls can never take care of themselves as boys did, which is funny because out of all four kids of hers, I'm the only one that heard my three brothers are still living with, still looking for wives for them. And
so you cut out for a second. Out of the four kids, you're the only one that...
I'm the only one that is successful and I'm completely independent.
And the other ones are in Saudi? Your siblings, are they still in Saudi?
Mm-hmm. And they all live with her.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Congratulations. I mean, so what happened? Like, did you leave the country? Or?
I did. I ended up going to America to study. But the way I did it was for a week. I went on a hunger strike and I didn't talk to them for a whole week. I'm just like,
wow, that's what you had to do?
Yeah, what else? I mean, my mom would yell at me. She's like, you're going to die if you don't eat. You're going to get anemia. And I still do have some
side effects.
Anemia, but it was due to other, it wasn't due to that. It was due to some anorexic things that I went through before.
I'm not surprised because the way they were treating you, no wonder, like, that's not healthy for any, I mean, no parent should be talking to, nobody should be talking to others, never mind a parent especially. I mean, you expect your parents to be the ones to nurture you and make you feel better about yourself but like, obviously, if your parents treat you like that, it's going to have psychological effects on you negatively, right, for long-term effects. So That's really unfortunate. Yeah. So you had to do, and wow, you're stubborn. Like you managed to get through this by.
Oh, I'm stubborn. You should ask my boyfriend.
but you managed to get out of that situation. I mean, wow. Like, I'm blown away at what you did. Okay, so you had a hunger strike, and then did that change the mind?
It changed. I think it was either my father talked to her and said, like, hey, you're really hurting our daughter. She's going to be with Aramco. Let her just, you know, you never know. So I think that then my mother came to me and she's like, only if you get accepted can you get in. And I'm like, got accepted. So I got in. College was very, it was everything. I could have probably done more, but in college, I also noticed how very controlling my parents were because they didn't trust me. They wanted me to be on Skype and they wanted to watch me the entire time. I had to come up with a bunch of shit like, oh, I have an exam I need to study for. And my mom would be like, well, keep us in the background. It's like, I'm going to the library. Or I would come up. So one of the things I also started doing was pretend to be religious. So my mom would call me and then I would pretend to read Dua or Ziyara or Quran or something like that. And my mom would be like weirded out and she wouldn't know what to do. And that's when she would be like, okay, I'll let you go. Bye. and I'm like, yeah. I can go do shit now. Also in college is when I left Islam. It started out in high school because I've seen when I started seeing the discrepancies between how I'm treated and how the boys are treated, and I hated how that is different in reading the Quran, especially reading the Quran. People keep saying to ex-Muslims, I hope that you read the Quran and keep an open mind. And I'm like, yeah, ditto. I kept an open mind because, like, I have.
Yeah.
And the Quran, where is it? It should be here somewhere. I don't know where it is. It's here somewhere. I have it. It's especially with Surah An-Nisa that people keep talking about. Like, you know, there's a whole chapter in the Quran about us. Yeah, a chapter that says that a man can marry up to 4 wives, that your husband has complete control of you and can tell you what to do. He's treating you like a minor. People concentrate on the hitting verse. How about the part where he has the right to discipline her like a child? Women don't have that option.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's that part, that ayah, and the ayah where in order for women to deal with their husbands that don't like them or don't want them. Yes, it is. The whole Quran is addressed to men. There's maybe I can't remember, and maybe you can remember this the ayah, but in tafsir back in high school, there was an ayah that came out mainly because all of the Quran was addressed to men and women were being the Muslim women were getting upset, like, how come the Quran never addresses us? And then the Quran decided to address both, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is in Al-Mu'minun. Is it in Surah Al-Mu'minun? I think it might be. I can't remember.
Yeah, but, it was because everything was men, and then the Sahabiya, they were like, well, what about us? And then the Quran came up with a verse that said, for the believing men and the believing women, the fasting men and the fasting. Oh, I found it. Hold on. 33:35. It's indeed the Muslim men and Muslim women, believing men, believing women, obedient men, obedient women, truthful men, and still talking about men too.
Yes. Like, isn't it such a beautiful, equal religion of both sexes? Like, oh. That's essentially how I became an ex-Muslim, is I hated how I treated women. And it also was kind of beginning of my healing process because that's when I first started going to therapy and starting to understand, myself and how I think. Because I always thought something was wrong with me, with the way I think. Like, how come everybody in my family is deeply, you know, into this religion. They love it. They talk about the imams and the prophet as if they are these amazing people. And I just, it never clicked with me. I thought maybe that's just something wrong with me. And it wasn't until I started going to therapy, and this particular therapist that I'm very happy with, because he was also ex-Catholic, so he kind of understands the guilt that I come with, because how also Catholics get this whole guilt thing sprinkled into them. Shia have this also with them. And he understood it, and he helped guide me and make me understand that there's nothing wrong with me, that I'm not a bad person for not wanting to believe in this religion and not wanting to believe in, you know, this, or just not believing in a God, because I just didn't. I realized at that point, and that's how I became an ex-Muslim, is that I was more afraid of my mother than I was afraid of this God, because I didn't believe in it. I believed in my mom because she was real and she was scary as fuck. Mm-hmm. And when she had complete control over me, because my father also had complete control over me. And with the guardian system back then, parents had complete authority over you. It's a little bit less now, but it's unbelievable. So when I had my first relationship afterwards, I'm not proud of it, but unfortunately the cycle of abuse continued. So I became like my mother with my significant other. I was very condescending. I was narcissistic. Everything was about me. Didn't know how to communicate, because the only thing I saw was my parents' relationship, and my parents' relationships was shitty. They hated each other. They somehow managed to find a way to make it work. But in the beginning, I saw that they were angry at each other all the time, screaming at each other, yelling at each other. And as a child, growing up in such a household, it really does create a lot of anxiety. And you'll notice that when you read books about, like, you know, people with social anxiety and other anxiety issues, is that they usually grow up in households that are not very stable, especially growing up and finding parents that are constantly fighting, constantly bringing you into the fights. I don't want to be part of my parents' fights, please. And having my dad tell me don't be like your mom, or my mom telling me don't be like your dad, it's like you're in the middle, and you really don't deserve this. You really don't. And that's not the right way of raising children. So, and because that's what your kids see, you know, that's what they think is a healthy relationship, is it's these two people that don't like each other, have nothing in common, just yelling at each other, calling each other names, and then behind each other's back tell you also names about them. So unfortunately, that's what I did with my first relationship, and I regret it and I hate it. But as part of my my therapy also, I realized that I realized the normal things, like men can't read your mind. Sometimes you have to spell it out with them. You want them to call you every day at 5, fucking tell them that they need to call you every day at 5. And that's the first thing I learned in therapy, in how to be in a healthy relationship, is that you need to communicate. Communication is such an important thing. And I kept that as still, to this day, the most important aspect in any relationship. But that's not just a romantic relationship, your friendships, your if you are in a family. Having a clear line of communication where you use, I statements, like, hey, I don't feel very good about this, instead of just saying, like, you made me feel this. Because that's what we learned from our parents, right? Like, your parents tell you, you're making me feel like this. You're making me angry. Look at what you're making to my health. But that's not it. And when your parents say that to you, that's abuse. That's emotional abuse, because they chose to let that affect them. They chose to let that affect their health. So that's when I first learned that I'm being as abusive as my mother. And I went back to therapy and I worked a lot on myself. When I realized the reason I finally went to a doctor, not just a therapist, was after I had a break, a breakdown, and it was when I was about 23, and I was in a relationship, a different relationship than the one that I was being abusive in. But I was so obsessed. The second option was to get married, to get out of my parents' house, because the education didn't help. I still had to go back, and I still had to work in Aramco with my parents and live with my parents. So I needed to get out. My other option was not have to get married. So I was dating somebody, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I was really hoping that he would marry me and just, you know, save me from all of that. But unfortunately, that didn't work. So when that didn't happen, I completely broke down. And I went the next day to a doctor, got referred to a psychiatrist, put on medication, and then started very intensive therapy. And that is that because I was robbed of having a mother figure in my life that understood and was there for me when I needed her, because my mother wasn't. Other mothers, you know, when you go to them and, you know, you're feeling down because somebody hurt you, they don't take that opportunity to continue to, you know, kick you while you're down. My mother, on the other hand, her about something. She just takes that as an opportunity to bring in all the other criticisms that she has of me. Like, hey, you know, I don't like the way you talk. Maybe this is why your boss was very angry at you. Or, well, maybe have you ever considered that there's something wrong with you? That's why these people are doing this? Like, what the fuck kind of mother does that? And so what I started doing is, any relationship that I was in, I just gave the man all of the power over me because I wanted them to love me like my mom. I would talk to them. I would use them for the emotional support that I never got. And I still am working on that to this day. Like, I don't have essentially a good grasp on that, but that's at least something that made me realize it. And it also was the first time I realized that I can leave this country. But unfortunately, all good things, I mean, sometimes you don't get to a better point until you go down and hit
even more.
Mm-hmm. And I did. And yeah. It was about 2014 when another friend of mine passed away. My job went to shit. My family was bad. I broke up with a guy that I was seeing. And it was just, I just couldn't take it anymore. I just hated my life. Waking up every morning felt like I just wanted the day to end. Like, when I go to sleep, I'm like, I just hope I don't wake up, or I wake up like 10 years from now or something like that. Like, I just hated having to go through every day. And one day I came back home and I took some pills and I thought that that's it. I was going to die. Like, I had already written my, I still have my suicide note, actually. I wrote my suicide note and everything, and I really just wanted to die, but it didn't work out. And I woke up in the middle, like about like 4 hours later, and just a headache and stomach hurting, went back to sleep, woke up, that was it. But wow. That is also when I realized I needed to leave. And as part of, it was also like when I realized and accepted that my life here, this was it. Like, this is, there was no changing my parents. There was no changing Sally. There was no changing my family. The only thing I can do is change how I react to it. And that's when I realized, like, hey, if I'm going to die, but the world is huge. The world is so big. I can just leave. I can just go anywhere. Like, I even was like, maybe I should just go to fucking Cambodia and live there. I just don't care anymore. Like, I just didn't want to live in Saudi with my parents anymore. Packed a bag, came to the U.S. This is such a oversimplification of what I did, but essentially that's what I did. I packed a bag, got on a plane, came here.
Yeah.
Got asylum. It was very, very difficult. But the weird thing is, when I first got here, even though it was difficult, and you know, it was still, you know, trying to figure out my life, but I wasn't as depressed because I was like on survival mode, you know, going from one step to the other, to the other, until I was able to find a job, until I was able to find stability, a place to live, get my green card, get everything. So when everything finally, you know, got to the point where it's settled, now I have a job, I have stability, I have a place to live, I have a green card, everything's okay. And then everything just comes like a wave and just crashes onto you. And you realize that everything that you've gone through, it just goes through your mind all the time. And in this new book that I'm reading on children, give you the name of it. It is, because I really like it. It's called, on Audible, don't be a little bitch. It's about children of abusive parents, essentially. And it talks about mainly alcoholics, but adult children of dysfunctional mm-hmm. families.
Okay.
It is by John Friel and Linda something. So
it's called 19, adult... Extreme Dependency.
Is that my phone?
20.
It's a book.
That's the book. So the book talks about adult children of dysfunctional families. It describes how, normal people, and then all of a sudden, there's like a switch, and everything just comes crashing down. It's usually when everything is stable. Yeah, so that's like a year or so, I started feeling really, really down, like really, like how on, like why did this happen? And I think the timing with, with the Rona and with, my brothers was also like in the process of trying to get married. My parents still don't talk to me. They refuse to. My mother, for example, still likes to say that I'm dead to her. And
jeez.
Yeah, they don't talk to me at all, like to the point where my boyfriend tried to introduce himself to them via email, letting them know, like, hey, I'm the man that's going to marry your daughter. They just looked at it as if it's, an insult to them. How dare this person even come to us and tell us all of these things? But it didn't help, of course, being, with the coronavirus and having to be on your own. And again, before that, with not having all this time to think about all of the things that happened to you. I remember just feeling so down, so depressed that I just didn't know what to do. So that's when my healing process finally, like, I took it seriously. Like, now I want to get better. I have to get better. I took it upon myself, like, if I wanted to live the rest of my life and be healthy, I need to stop looking at the past and start looking about in the future. So I started looking at all sorts of different therapies, all sorts of different treatments. And I know I suffer from major depressive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. And it's part of it is biological. Part of it is due to, outside sources. But unfortunately, a lot of it is chemical. So that's why I have to take medication for God knows when. But the thing about, different types of therapies that you start, like you can do talk therapy, that could work, that couldn't work. Medication, unfortunately, takes a very long time. But I really do believe 100% that there is something out there for everyone. I really did not believe that there would be something for me. A lot of the medications would stop working, and then I would have to change them. I would do talk therapy, and talk therapy would just make me so angry. But then I learned about different types of therapy. So there's also trauma therapy, and trauma therapy is a different type of therapy that doesn't necessarily concentrate more on talk aspects and more about how your body reacts to it. That's in somatic experiencing. And it's the way we did it was I would talk about a past traumatic experience that I went through, for example, and would remind that. And then I would look at how my body reacts to it, how my heart is beating, how my chest feels, how my hot, my cold, how my extremities feel, and then trying to redirect that in a different manner. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, But even though in the beginning it made me feel like it's not really working, after a while I started to realize that every time a trigger happens, instead of the thoughts that go through my mind, I'm thinking more about how it's making me feel, and that kind of grounds you. So I really do suggest trauma therapy, like as a beginning, as a start, if you have gone through abuse, because it is a lot different than talk therapy, and it does address certain aspects. So of course, you have to stick with it, have to go the long term with it, and it's difficult, it's hard, because you do have to revisit a lot of unpleasant memories, but it does do a lot of help.
That's interesting, because I know one of the forms of meditation is called body scanning, where you, when you're meditating, you're trying to, you feel your body. That's good to know. I mean, even for someone that's not necessarily at the same level of trauma that you went through, these are useful tools in anyone's toolkit, that when you get angry about something, try to feel your body again. I mean, I like that. That's cool. I'll look into that a little bit more.
Yeah, and the body scan, that's the first thing that we do in trauma therapy. A body scan is that, you know, if she starts off, my therapist would start off by asking me how I'm feeling, what's going on. And then when she saw that I'm getting a little distressed, she would stop me and ask me to go through the body scan. And that actually leads me to the second part of the therapy that I really liked, which is ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And acceptance and commitment therapy, I was so hesitant about it for the longest time, because it sounded like it was just like giving up and just accepting everything. But what ACT is all about essentially is that the world is full of suffering. It's not perfect. There's going to be injustice. All we can do really is accept that it's there and try to make the best of what you have right now. Which actually brings back to the meditation and mindfulness. It has a huge emphasis on both mindfulness and acceptance. So you have to accept the life that you have right now and be mindful and live your life as is. And I know this is very difficult for people that have gone through a lot of trauma. It was extremely horrible and heartbreaking for me, and it was very, very hard, especially the acceptance part. The acceptance part takes, as I said, it's not a linear. You accept it today, you may not accept it tomorrow, you may accept it 3 years from now, but then one day you want to wake up and it's not, you know, you don't accept it anymore. And that is totally fine. And that's part of ACT, is being compassionate with yourself and understanding that you may not accept it every day. And that is okay, because what happened to you is not okay. What happened to me was not okay. What happens to ex-Muslims all over the world is not okay. Abuse is not okay. And we know that it's not okay, but we accept that it did happen. We cannot change it. The only thing we can do is try to make the best of what is happening right now. And, you know, for me, it was very difficult, especially that I couldn't get my mind to stop. My mind was always going and going and going. So I started looking at different therapies, different treatments. And there are several different treatments for depression that are not just medication, that are not just therapy. There is ketamine treatments, infusions that you could do. There are a lot of clinics out there that do it. And I hear really good, you know, responses from that. There is electromagnetism, I think, that is really good. I've heard, and it has really good, you know, results as well. What I did was electroconvulsive therapy. And even though it may sound scary, because everybody thinks about, you know, one flew over the cuckoo's nest, that's not how it is. But it is a very extensively studied treatment. It's very effective for PTSD, which is why it's used on veterans that go to, you know, that see active combat. It's very good for depression in general. It's been used, which is why it was used in the past and is still used now. But now it's extremely regulated. It's there's a lot of research if you want to look into it, because the other two treatments are still new, so they're still being tested. But electroconvulsive therapy has been around for God knows how long. ECT has been for it's been going on for a very long time, and now it's all under anesthesia, so you don't even know what's happening to you. You just wake up and you feel maybe a little bit of like
tingling?
Soreness in your jaws, because it is you know, electromagnetic shock, and it does kind of induce a seizure. So you will fight, they put something in your mouth, so you can fight it. And I did about 8 sessions of that, and honestly, I never thought that it could work, but it did.
Oh, wow.
It's one of those, and I know people that have done the ketamine treatments and it has helped them. And I've known people that did the electromagnetism, thing. I can't remember it. I'm so sorry. If I remember the name, I will text you, but I can't remember it now. But it's a very good type of treatment for, treatment resistant depression. Doesn't do very much for anxiety, but with comorbid anxiety, it does help quite a lot with that, because a lot of people have depression and comorbid anxiety that is caused by the depression. So it really is very, very helpful.
What does that mean, comorbid?
Comorbid, kind of like it's kind of resulting from, I think.
Oh, okay.
I think so. So you would have like depression, and with the depression comes anxiety.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask about, I know that the doing research right now in America on psilocybin for depression, so basically shrooms. Have you done any research on that? If that, it resets your brain or something?
I haven't really done that much. I would, I do hope to read more on that, but right now I feel a lot better at how managing my my problems right now. But what I've heard about psychedelics and psilocybin is if once there's more controlled ways of doing it, I would definitely would, if I still have problems with accepting, because one of the things I understood from one study I read is that they've given psilocybin to cancer patients or terminally ill patients, and found out that it has helped them accept where they're at.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, that's like the biggest thing. Like, how can I get acceptance? Maybe if I do this, but I don't want to do it on my own.
Yeah.
I'm not into psychedelics, mainly because I'm afraid of what's in my mind. And I would really like if there's some, like a doctor there to make sure I'm not reacting badly or having a bad trip. So that's just my look at into it. I've known people that have done it on their own, and they feel like microdosing and doing it every once in a while has helped them quite a lot. But I don't have a lot of research onto it. I'm more the person that I've done every single therapy that has ever come out.
Yeah.
And, including a very, I did an intensive outpatient therapy for about 6 months. The actual course work is a year, but I couldn't do it for a year because money issues, and also because I was starting to feel better, and it's worked really, really well for me, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. And dialectical behavioral therapy is a therapy that is actually mainly used for borderline personality disorder and major depressive, suicidal, depression. And it's a combination of different therapies, in a combination of like trauma, talk, cognitive behavioral therapy. There is a lot of mindfulness, a lot of meditation, a lot of ACT as well. It's like has all of those others put into one. And it also, the best thing I can think of it is, the best way I can describe it is, it's kind of like a way to parent yourself, because the way we grew up, our parents didn't teach us these really important coping mechanisms. So we were on our own trying to figure out our own coping mechanisms. So this therapy that I got into, which is one of the reasons I like it, unlike talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, this gives you a list of skills that you can use in real time in order to help you with, how to deal with certain situations. And it's, some of them are very, they're, when you look at them, that you're thinking like this is like, I should have been like 10 years old and my mom should have told me this, for example, there is distract, feeling angry, or you're feeling distressed, distract yourself, go for a run, dip your head in ice or some cold water. Or another one is like interpersonal communication skills, like how to ask, what is considered a healthy relationship, what is not considered a healthy relationship. And I still have the book for it, for dialectical behavioral therapy. It's, you can do it on your own if you would like, but I would highly suggest like a trained therapist to do it, because as part of dialectical behavioral therapy, there's, your own work that you do on your own. There's the individual therapy that you do with your individual therapist. And then there is a group therapy where you get to learn more about others and what they're going through and what has helped them. And how, and also, at first I didn't really understand the meaning behind it. Like, why do I need to sit every week and listen to a bunch of people? But it also teaches you empathy, which is, I believe, one of the biggest things in BPD and borderline is learning empathy and learning how to relate to somebody else. I'm making this up. I don't know if this is true. But it does teach you empathy, and it also really teaches you how to engage with other people if you don't have the interpersonal communication skills. And what helped me is that there are other people out there that are going through something very similar to what I am going through. For me, it was a lot of abusive, my abusive household. And listening to other people also talk about their abusive household and how they were able to get out of it. And, seeing, because everybody is in a different part of their journey. So you see people at the very beginning, you see people at the end, and you're letting them go and you're so happy, and you see them like, wow, they're actually knowing how to use these skills. They're doing, they're out there, they're living their lives. But I remember when I first started, I was like so angry at all these people that are so, because I think we graduated two people and, when I was in, and I was like, oh, those people are doing so well. I'm gonna be there.
Yeah.
And how much you get there?
How much of, how much of this is actually, a lot of it is coming from your family and your parents and the way they treated you. How much of it is anger towards Islam? Is that any part of it for you at all? Anger towards, being raised. I mean, they kind of go together. Right? I mean, it's hard to separate the two because, they force you to pray. So like, that's part of the religion. Like, you have to force your kids to pray and even beat them. Like the hadith says, you beat them at a certain age. So that's like, it's all mixed together, isn't it?
Yes. So for me, it's mainly in the beginning, it was, I hate Islam because I can't do this, I can't do that, having to cover up. Later on, it became more of how I hate Islam and how it's taken over my family. I hate that it's, I hate how it completely stripped them of their humanity, because there's, so the latest thing that we tried to do in order to see if maybe this is the last, like the last type of reaching out to my parents and seeing that maybe this would get their biological responses running, was my boyfriend, as I said, introduced himself as the, the man that wants to marry me. And we said, we thought that maybe this would get them to do something. But instead, they just got angry. And how dare she, after everything that she's done, they never said that to me. I heard that from, the grapevines.
Yeah.
And, how dare they, how dare she say that to us? How dare she, after everything that she's done, after everything that she said about religion. So they don't even look at me as their daughter anymore. Mm. Like, I'm no longer their daughter. I'm just a Kafir, you know. And I'm the concept of walwala and walbara, you know, that you can only be loyal to other Muslims and you have to be, you know, not loyal to Muslims. So non-Muslims, so
really
not a Muslim. I don't deserve the loyalty or the love. And I hate Islam mainly because it makes love so conditional. It kills your biological instincts to want to love your child. I mean, I'm not a parent, but you know, I hope to be, and I cannot imagine a world where I'm going to look at my child and be like, I don't love him because he decided to be somebody else other than what I had envisioned in my head.
It doesn't make sense. I do know that I've heard many people tell me, including, I mean, frankly speaking, I'll just say it, including my own dad and mom. My dad is Ismaili. My mom is Sunni. So they didn't like my dad because he's not Sunni, right? But like when I was born, then my grandparents, they opened up to my dad because they have a grandchild now, right? I mean, in your case, it's different because your family's in Saudi. So that's tougher. But there's a possibility, you know, off sometimes when, I mean, My grandparents were not like, they weren't like your family. They weren't like crazy religious fundamentalists. My grandma's a sweet lady and my grandpa was, they were religious, but they weren't like that. I mean, we were in Kenya, right? So Kenyan Muslims don't tend to be like super religious. They're religious, but they're not like your family. So I guess but you know, hopefully, you never know, you know, things can change, but unfortunately they do seem very toxic, and it's probably better that they're not in your life because it is what it is, you know?
Yeah, that's the other thing that I was going to mention. It's like, okay, I have a kid. That's when my boyfriend said, but maybe when we have kids that, you know, they'll come along. It's like, do I really want that kind of toxicity around my children? Do I want my mother's toxicity around my kids? And you've seen how they've done to me. Do I really want that to be around them? I mean, if they change, that's, you know, hayya Allah, but if they're not.
there's a lot of boundary management, right? When in situations like that, you have to let them know, like, hey, no, not like that, not around my kids, you know, that's not acceptable. And, you know, it's tough, right? It's part of life when you have parents like that. Yeah, what a journey. What a journey you've had. And by the way, for those of you who are watching, please thumbs up the stream if you're enjoying the interview with Gada. That helps the algorithm, helps people to find the channel. And just hit 10,000 subs. So, yay. You know, it's a new channel. Trying to get back to where it was before. And Gada, thank you. This has been quite, you know, quite a lot. It takes a lot out of you, I think, to talk about this, because you have to go through the world experience again in your mind. You know, I hope that people that are watching who have gone through the same thing will find some, you know, benefit in what you're saying, and, you know, maybe go for therapy. That seems like a big part of it. That helped a lot. What else would you like to share in terms of like advice to people that are struggling either with the religion or either with, you know, family issues? Do you have any advice you want to give to people?
Yes, I have two things I wanted to say. First of all, it's okay to be selfish. the one thing I did in order to finally come here is I chose my own happiness over my parents. And I know growing up, you know, you love your parents. Nobody does it. Even after everything, I love my parents, and I don't want to hurt them. But it's okay to prioritize your happiness over somebody else's. It's okay. Because you're not doing anything wrong. Be selfish and do the thing that makes you happy. And if it makes you happy to be away, if it makes you happy to, you know, pursue your education or travels or live on your own or anything like that, just to be yourself, then go ahead and do it. And the other thing I want to mention is that age really is nothing. It doesn't mean a word. It doesn't mean fucking shit. Just because, you know, you're 30 and you're still stuck with your parents' house, don't say that, you know, this is going to be the rest of my life, or if I go out now then I'm not going to be able to find anything. That's just bullshit. You live in a world where age is just a number, and if your society keeps telling you that you're old because of your age, like mine did, and it's very difficult because I still struggle with this, and I still think that I'm, you know, too old to go out and do my own things. Like, I can't wear shorts, or I can't wear this, or I can't wear that. And like, no, I'm 32. I wear shorts. I wear fucking jeans that are ripped or whatever it is that people wear these days. I'm, you know, go out and start dating at fucking 35. Who cares? If that's like what you're afraid of, and continue to say no to your parents if they keep on giving you that trishta, you know, just say no.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Gada. This has been quite an adventure, quite a journey to your life, and I do hope that it helps other people. I just want to add, for people that are kind of wondering what's the connection between Islam and the story, it's always mixed up together. It's never clear cut. You know, sometimes people like to make a no true Scotsman and say, well, that's not Islam, that's culture. But you can't really do that, because the two things are always intertwined. Like, the culture and the religion, they go together. The religion affects the culture affects the religion. Religion is not something that sits in Sahih Bukhari and the Quran on a shelf. That's not what religion is. Religion is a manifestation of that book with people's lives, with the culture, with the traditions and the cultures, and how they change, and how they're influenced by those teachings, and how the scholars interpret it, and how families use these teachings in the family. Like, when parents beat the kids because they're not praying, or when they force them to pray, or when they think the most important thing in life is that you have to, you know, protect the religion over your own child's good, you know, like, you above your the well-being of your child, because you think the well-being of your child, of Islam, is more important than your child, or you think that this is not well-being, even if she's happy but she doesn't have Islam. You might say, oh, your daughter is happy, or she looks happy, well, everything seems good for her, but she's not Muslim. Oh no, she can't be, that's not good. That whole calculation, the whole evaluation, the whole process of how Islam affects that is such a big part of why Gada and why I and all of us, you know, why we talk about these things. And it's not, you know, the process of talking about Islam, it's not that Islam is the only bad thing in the world. Islam has some good things in it too, but we talk about it because it affected us. Like, it's part of our lives. It was a big part of our lives, and for better or worse, we don't think it's good for the world, right? And that's why we talk about it. We want people to know that, you know, on the whole, the world would be better without these things, right? And so you're most welcome to practice Islam, to believe in Islam, to be Muslim. That's your choice. That's not the problem. The problem is when people don't get a choice, right? And I think everyone should agree that if someone has the right to convert to Islam, it only makes sense that people have the right to leave Islam. Otherwise, I mean, that's just not, you just don't have consistent values. You're basically a fascist. You're saying that people don't have the right to choose for themselves. And then that even goes against what the Quran says about La ikraha fid din. There's no compulsion in the religion. Of course, the Quran has other things that contradict that as well. But the point is, what's the value of someone following something if they're compelled? What's the value of forcing your child to be Muslim if they don't believe in it? Like, Allah has no need of fake worship. Allah has no need of someone pretending to be Muslim. That's the worst thing of all, right? It's useless. It's basically, it's worse than disbelief, right?
Right. It's almost we have no choice. We can't be munafiqeen, so we can't just force ourselves to be like that, and we can't be, you know, ex-Muslim. It's like we it's either munafiqeen or killed.
Yeah. So those of you who were needing help, and I know ex-Muslims of North America is going through a bit of a transformation right now, and so it's more about, you know, advocacy and less about meetups and stuff like that. There is still the ex-Muslim Reddit, the other groups on Facebook you can find, the other places you can find to discuss. Gada, do you have any recommendations for people that are looking for, like, you know, people of like-minded people? What would you suggest to people like that?
For like-minded people, definitely check if your city has an XMNA group. I know that the main XMNA does not essentially do the, the groups anymore, but they have become independent, and my group has become independent, and we still go out and do our own thing. So just look, just check your city and see if there's anyone out there. Of course, the you know, the ex-Muslim subreddit is pretty good. There's several Facebook groups that you can join. And also for therapy, because I know that not everybody here is in America or Canada, but there are, but BetterHelp.com does have that DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, and has different types of therapy. So if you you know, want something that you can, you know, access online, there's that. There's also a lot of therapists online that you can, and you can go on, and psychologytoday.com also is very good and has really a good amount of information that can be helpful. And also the book that I mentioned, then there's also Children of the Children of the Self-Absorbed, which is Children of Narcissistic Parents. If I had these books in front of me, I should have done that before.
You can send me the list after. I'll add it to the description. I'll add, you know, that's a great idea.
I'll send you the three books that I have, you know, helped me.
Awesome. I mean, that's a big part of it too, is, I mean, I think that you're taking all the right steps in, you know, in terms of like trying to, I mean, that self-reflection is amazing, because there's people that are in relationships of their whole lives and don't realize that they're the problem because of their dysfunctional parents and whatever. It could be their parents, could be anything. I mean, whatever the reason they are, the way they are, they don't even realize it. And they think they're the good guys in the relationship, but they're not. And I'm so happy to hear that you were self-aware and you were able to realize how you actually caused harm in the relationship, and you fix that, and you're working towards, you know, improving yourself. This is a big part of, you know, this is the best part of being human. And one of the best things that anyone can do is keep reading books, keep researching, talk to people, keep learning. Don't limit yourself. Don't think that, you know, I've reached, you know, I'm fine. And, you know, a lot of times it's trauma that pushes us into that. It doesn't have to be, but I know this, I've gone through the same thing as well. When I was going through some tough times, it caused me to, you know, get a bunch of books and read, and it actually helped me a lot, you know. And reading is so important. We hardly read nowadays, and Audible is a good way to consume some of that, you know, because some people don't like sitting and reading. You can listen to it, you can go for the walk.
I'm going to give you the ACT book, but the ACT book is much, much better when you sit down and do all of the work, because that I got the hard copy for it, because you need to do like
actual. Wonderful. Any last words before we go? I know we discussed before, we're not going to share, you're not sharing your social media. If anyone wants to leave a comment, they can just do it here. Anything else you want to add? Any final last words for you?
Just, you know, everybody don't give up. World is big. I promise you it is humongous. And you're not alone. You really are not. We all have gone through it. And even if you think that you're too old now to go get help, there's no such thing. I've known people that have started going to a doctor when they were in their 40s and their 50s. It's totally fine. If you need help, please don't hesitate to go. Even if you have to do it on your own or online, just seek out.
Wonderful. Okay, everyone, it's been a wrap. Thanks for joining and thanks for being there. And hopefully we'll see you again soon. I know I haven't been making a lot of content lately. I apologize for that. I have been extremely busy at the office, and, you know, it spills over into my personal life when there's, you know, only limited time for family, work, and activism. So sometimes activism has to take a little bit of a step back. I do appreciate this conversation, Gada. Thank you, everyone, for watching. And this is your friendly ex-Muslim signing out. Bye for now.